there is intrinsic to modern farming a whole apparatus of control which seeks to manipulate every aspect of the animal's life. But beyond this, I think the real crux of the matter is the desire to control the narrative around the moment of that animal's death.
Few issues spark as much debate right now than the question of what we should eat, whether we're talking about our health, climate change, or ethics. And the issues of meat and livestock no doubt comprise the fiery molten core of that debate. As a species with hundreds of thousands of years of hunting and fishing in our belts at least, of being in good relations with our non-human neighbors, how did we get to this point? And what do we make of the stark, polarized debates which are clearly not moving us forward? This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. Today we're looking at the apparent paradoxes and contradictions of eating meat. Some argue that animal agriculture needs to be entirely abolished on environmental as well as ethical grounds, while others argue that animals can be critical to regenerative agricultural practices and that it's possible to work with and even consume animals in an ethical way. Rob Percival, author of the forthcoming book, The Meat Paradox, has given these various threads quite a lot of thought. His book is an interesting examination of the issue and also reflection on how he personally has engaged this ethical space. If you're looking for a one side or the other conversation, this ain't it. Let's dig in. In this episode, we have the pleasure of hearing from Rob Percival, author of the soon-to-be-released book, The Meat Paradox. Rob is head of food policy for the Soil Association, a charity in the United Kingdom that seeks to help everyone understand and explore the vital relationship between the health of soil, plants, animals, and people. The Meat Paradox is a fascinating book that seeks to walk a constructive tightrope along the stark polarization that has emerged with respect to the role of animals in our food systems and diets. Rob, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me. Very pleased to be here.
Thank you also for sharing an early version of your book. This issue of meat eating is at the center of so many discussions about climate change, about transforming our food systems, about animal rights. So can you get us started maybe by explaining in a general sense what you mean when you say the meat paradox?
Sure. So there's this fairly obvious observation that we're quite capable of caring for animals and we're quite capable of treating them very badly. And we, in some situations, in some instances, we exercise compassion and empathy towards other species. And in others, we treat them with an almost abusive disregard. And this has been observed for many, many years. This isn't a novel observation. But in the past decade, a group of social psychologists have started to dig under the cognitive skin, if you like, of our relationship with farmed animals to try and work out what the pressures and forces are that skew our relationship in that context. And this has generated this fascinating body of research, which shows that we're deeply conflicted in that relationship, and that there are these semi-conscious forces which skew our thought and behavior in really fascinating ways.
And you do talk about these in the book, but the book is also a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, the book explores some of those tensions and digs down to a more fundamental question, which is really what sort of creatures are we that we find eating animals so disturbing in some contexts? You know, we evolved as omnivores, we evolved eating animals, and we're kind of unique among other species that eat animals in that we find it potentially distressing. As far as we know, the bear doesn't mourn the salmon, you know, the lion doesn't feel any mixed feelings about eating the gazelle, but we might. So what changed there, and what does that mean for us today?
I appreciate your connection to deep history, to our evolutionary history there. And I appreciate that about the book. You know, in the book, you talk about this really wonderful and compelling carving, The Lion Man, which is about 40,000 years old, possibly, you know, the earliest known piece of such art. And in the book, you position The Lion Man throughout the narrative as something of a hero figure or a guide through the book. You come back to it a couple of times and it seems symbolic for the journey that you're describing. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm curious, why did you start your book with this symbol, the Lion Man, instead of setting the tone with what might have been a more predictable framing, like climate change?
Well, the you'll have observed, and you've alluded to the fact that the debate around meat has become highly polarized, very emotive. Not very many months ago, there were conservative pundits in the US warning that Joe Biden's going to take away your hamburger. You know, these issues really cut to the core of our identity. And in the UK, we have a government that's afraid of talking about dietary change. And a lot of what's going on within this debate is beyond the realm of reason. These aren't rational arguments that are taking place. They're really emotion-driven arguments whose psychological roots reach back into our deep past. And if we want to understand what's going on today, the way that these forces are skewing the debate and shaping our lives, then we have to go back to the beginning, almost to the transition that took place very many years ago, when we did become, in some sense, different to the animals around us. We began to feel conflicted about our own omnivory, our own mode of subsistence. We began to empathize with the animals that we consumed. And that had enormous consequences for human society. It posed an enormous dilemma, which each culture has had to try and deal with, each in its own way. And our way of dealing with it at the moment falls far short. So it ventures into the past in search of how others might have resolve the paradox or found a route through it, in the hope that we might remember a little of what and who we are. You talk about this thing in your book, the great forgetting, I think is the phrase you use, the sense that we've forgotten where we've come from and that there's wisdom to be drawn on from other societies that are a bit closer to that truth. And it's a resonant idea, I think.
So are you saying that we need to make these conversations more rational, or that we need to accept and acknowledge that it's not rational and it won't be?
The latter of those two, yeah. I mean, there's an important role for reason and rational dialogue around meat, but the crux of our relationship with animals is a really complex set of emotions. And those emotions shape the way we think and act, whether we're the most hardcore carnivore or whether we're a vegan or something in between. There's a tension, if you like, between our biological and ecological entanglement, which means that for many millennia we have had to eat animals, and we're still, I think, learning or figuring out what it might mean to disentangle ourselves if that's what we want to do. So there's a tension between that entanglement and a sort of ethical impulse to do no harm, which conflicts with our situation, and we have to make sense of that. And making sense of that is not a wholly rational business.
One of the things I really like about this book is I think you make a really good case that it is inherently uncomfortable. That's part of the relationship, is that discomfort. What also makes me think about your book is that you very clearly also put yourself in some uncomfortable spaces while you were writing it. So, for example, you tell an uncomfortable story like the slaughterhouse experience. And that reminded me of something I read about in my book. But the first time I encountered up close a cow with a fistula. It's essentially a cow with a big, large hole in the side and, you know, a plug that allows scientists to reach in and out and see how they're digesting things. You know, when I first met this cow, the scientist was taking me on a tour and he offered me a glove and let me reach in. And it just, you know, it struck me as so perverse, but also so indicative of this weird relationship that we've developed in our Western culture, if you want to call it that, with domesticated livestock and other animals. So as you worked through this book, what has transformed our relationship with domesticated animals, or even animals in general, in such a dysfunctional or perhaps even pathological direction?
I remember that episode within your book, and I think you described it as a sort of walking petri dish, as an industrial relationship that's emerged with this living being, which has been reconfigured on purely instrumental or utilitarian terms. And I think it comes back to this drive for control, which is quite characteristic in many ways of modern industrial society and its relationship with the natural world. There is intrinsic to modern farming a whole apparatus of control, which seeks to manipulate every aspect of the animal's life, especially in the more industrial systems, in order to just maximize the utility of that animal, the meat or materials that it provides for us. But beyond this, I think the real crux of the matter is the desire to control the narrative around the moment of that animal's death. This is really what the whole ethical debate comes down to. What happens when you stand in front of that animal with a knife and take its life? And there's a component of that experience, which I think can't be controlled, which sits beyond our control. And in every society, you find a whole web of stories and myths and narratives which try to make sense of what happens in that moment. And in our attempts to make sense of that moment, we've spun wildly off into a trajectory wherein we seek to control everything else around that moment in order to distance ourselves from it. There's a fascinating study which is part of the literature of the meat paradox, which shows our deep desire to distance ourselves from the consequences of that moment. So it's quite straightforward, really, but very telling. So there are two groups. Researchers have gathered two groups, and they've given each group a set of questionnaires to complete. They don't know why they're there, these volunteers. They're just doing their thing. The questionnaires cover all sorts of topics. It's not just about animals. They're asking about a whole range of things. And one group is given a bowl of cashew nuts to snack on, and the other group is given a bowl of beef jerky. And as the questionnaires run through, there's one that's around, asks about the sentience of the cow, its intelligence, and the moral concern that those volunteers feel towards animals in general. And the researchers found that the volunteers that were snacking on beef jerky were more inclined to lower their estimation of the cow's sentience. They rated the cow as being less mindful, less aware, less deserving of moral concern. And they extended that moral concern to a smaller circle of animals. And this had all happened beneath the threshold of conscious thought. They didn't know they were doing this, but the act of eating meat while being asked about a cow had generated these mixed feelings, probably quite tepid ones, but they had responded to them in quite a subtle way. When you stand in a slaughterhouse face to face with a cow, those feelings are much more potent and heated. But we see the same cultural strategies at play. That research study is really a microcosm of everything we try to do, which is deny the cow as a mindful person, an individual, create these systems of denial and distance around the animal's death, and distance ourselves from the consequences of that moment.
So trying to control it.
I think what's happening there is we're trying to control a set of feelings that we don't have full control over. We can't mute what we feel in that moment because it's pressed upon us from the outside. It doesn't matter how we rationalize or explain away what's going on in that moment. There's something innate where we are empathetic in the very structure of our being. And when we're faced with in this moment of embodiment with another being, there's something there that happens to us which can be very difficult to deal with.
One other point about that story you tell about the slaughterhouse, you know, when I was reading it, I wondered maybe if there was an inflection point for you in that experience, something about your understanding, something in your journey that changed while you were writing the book. Is that right? Did I catch something there that maybe changed for you in that experience?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you'd asked me about the sort of ethics of meat before that point, I'd probably have responded as most of us do in the abstract. You know, you construct some sort of line of reasoning that supports whatever stance you're taking. And I think what I saw in that moment was that reason only reaches so far in this debate. But so the confrontation with that pivotal moment that I recount in the slaughterhouse, the confrontation with that animal face to face, I think is what the whole meat debate ultimately boils down to. We've written reams and books about the trying to rationalize this view or the other, but ultimately it's that moment that matters.
There are places in this book where you use the word murder, and quite deliberately so, and I think appropriately so. But what it made me think of is in my own research and time working with Alaska Native peoples and communities in remote Alaska, you know, I came to sort out a fundamental difference or intuitive difference, you know, a difference between murder as an act of control and killing as an act of, maybe call it subsistence or call it predation. And I wonder how you respond to this distinction between an act of control being murder and other kinds of killing as something fundamentally different.
I mean, I think you can, there are very obvious and I think meaningful distinctions to be drawn between the sort of brutal mass killing of animals and modern industrial farming and what a subsistence hunter is doing in the forest. You know, they're not the same act. But then if you step into the shoes of the individual animal, you're still an individual who in every fiber of your being is possessed of this will to live. So when you shift perspective like that, you can see that there's a moral quandary in either case. The rationalization that we use to justify the act, or the story that we tell to describe it, whether it's an ecological act or an act of exploitation, can offer some comfort to us, can help us try and understand it. But the book suggests that we can never be entirely free from the risk that in that moment of the animal's death, we're confronted with this embodied being, which is placing a demand upon us, a demand that we do no harm, that we respect its life. And if we nevertheless take their life, then the risk is that we experience that as an act that's tantamount to murder.
You know, I really appreciate that answer, in part because I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but that is okay, because that, you know, that's what makes this book such a great contribution, is that it really draws out how contextual this issue is. And, you know, it's not just a binary or a universal issue that we're grappling with here. Earlier, we talked about how this is not just a rational issue. We're not going to rationalize our way out of them. But at the same time, right now in the world, so many people are actively trying to put numbers on this issue, to look at the trade-offs, a carbon price tag or a carbon footprint of this meat versus that meat versus Impossible Burgers and so forth. What I'm wondering from you, Rob, is what path forward do you see or are you seeing as you come out the other side of working on this book and thinking about this issue from a very personal as well as psychological and cultural level? How do these ideas sort of scale outward to how we might take action and think about the changes we need to make in our food systems, arguably sooner rather than later?
Well, I think part of it's probably very simple and part of it's very complicated. the simple part is that there's just an overwhelming body of evidence to suggest that we need to end the industrial farming of animals, phase out those intensive systems, change our diets accordingly. This isn't easily achieved because there are vested interests, there's a lot of money at stake, and partly because we're not immediately willing to change our diets in the right way. But I don't think there's a huge amount of doubt that we need to change the way that we produce and consume food, and at the center of that is phasing out these intensive livestock systems. Beyond that, it gets complicated, I think. There is an argument which says that we should remove all animals from the land and from our diets. And I don't think that is ecologically literate or nutritionally achievable necessarily.
I think there may even be a slippery slope in there somewhere.
Right. And I think part of that argument is fueled by this ethical insight, the realization that what we do to animals when we eat them is an act of the heaviest moral weight, and therefore we assume that the best option is to remove animals from our diets entirely, and that might be the case ethically. Maybe there's something in that, but it doesn't mean it's achievable. We did not evolve in such a way that it's readily achievable, at least I would say. The types of farming systems that we need to resolve the climate and nature crises are these sort of land sharing systems where we work with nature, where we integrate crops and animals in more complex systems. And there are
really important conversations we can have about what sort of lives those animals should lead, how long they should live, what it means to live with them. And equally, there's an important conversation to be had about the nutritional contribution of animal foods to our diets. I think most of us can subsist entirely healthily, probably on an entirely plant-based diet if it's of a high quality. But there are risks for some population groups. It's not as easy for infants and young children to get the nutrition they need. Pregnant mothers and older people have specific nutritional needs. So there are risks involved in removing animal products entirely in that context. And whatever mode of land management we arrive at, there's likely to be, even if it's a byproduct of conservation grazing and sort of rewilding and so on, there are animal foods, if you want to call them that, that will be available for eating. So that's the complicated conversation. You know, what's the most ethical and just farming system? How do we balance the needs of our biology with this ethical conundrum that we find ourselves in? And how do we do that very rapidly? Because the climate crisis is escalating and many people are hungry and you know, all these multiple challenges. So it's a really difficult thing. But just to finish off that trail of thought, in order to do that, we have to be aware of these big, thick cloaks of denial that we wrap around ourselves, the complex psychology that locks us into this really tangled relationship with meat. And we need to know where we came from, telling a more honest story about our relationship with other animals. And that's what the book tries to do, or at least tries to begin to do.
So what would you like to see in your lifetime? What would you like to see change significantly, perhaps radically? You know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but building on this conversation, you know, a sort of a capstone to all of this, I'm really curious to hear what you would like to see change.
I would say, if I were just to put one sort of fairly radical idea, it would be that we start to view meat as a byproduct, which might be highly prized and might still be consumed, but a byproduct of a farming system in which animals are primarily valued for their ecological contribution and their inherent dignity or worth. So they're we're talking about a radical shift beyond even sort of higher welfare farming as it is now, towards a mode of farming that puts animals first, that only includes them in our system, in the landscape, to the degree to which they contribute to ecological flourishing. And lots of this means letting go, less control, less management. It's not our system. It's a shared system with other facets of the natural world. And we only eat their meat as a byproduct of that system.
A shared system. That's great. Thank you very much, Rob. This was a really fantastic conversation, and I wish you the best of luck with the book. It comes out in March 2022, correct?
Yeah, it's out on the 1st of March in the US and the 3rd of March in the UK.
All right, well, thanks again. This episode of the Second Transition podcast was produced on the traditional lands and territory of the Washu people in what is now known as Northeastern California. Funding and other support for this podcast comes from the Arrow Food Institute at the University of Guelph and VoiceEd Radio. My guest today was Rob Percival, author of the forthcoming book, Meat Paradox. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.